Welcome. This is the e-learning course on the Nibbana Sermons 1 to 11 by Bhikkhu Katakurunda Nyanananda, an online course hosted by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And today we are on to sermon number 11. But first, a few things from the last forum discussion. Also, a remark by Robert Grosch. Our experience of Namarupa is merely a hollow reflection in a pond, a magic trick performed by Vijnana, which we keep trying to grasp in vain. And if we try to grasp the image of the reflection, all we do is to go fishing for one of the grasping groups, to stay with the simile of a reflection in a pond. And then there was a remark by Fred Martinson. He reported that he tried to contemplate Nama Rupa after sitting and generating some concentration. And he was wondering whether this is perhaps an insight practice. And yeah, I just wanted to mention that the question of contemplating Nama and Rupa can be done in connection with consciousness. Reciprocal relationship of mutual conditioning between the two. And so this can pretty much be applied in any kind of situation by simply distinguishing between the more passive, receptive presence of knowing and activities, mental activities, nama, and the experience of form of materiality. So it does not so much require getting into deep concentration, being able to analyze each single factor of name, which is of course also an interesting practice, but it can be simply done by this in any kind of situation, to drop back for a moment into that passive receptive knowing that is there. And from that viewpoint of that process of consciousness, of being conscious of experience, then it is possible to see the unfolding of the drama, of the movie of experience, the way we create and construct and dramatize things. And that can be a very insightful practice, and then we can, it's indeed possible to experience Nama Rupa as empty, as a magic trick, as a hollow reflection, and to become aware of this whirlpool between Nama Rupa and consciousness, and to emerge out of the dramas and movies that are so easily created. Then another comment by Kim Allen. It occurs to me that seeing is a particularly difficult sense door to penetrate with wisdom, because many visible objects look relatively permanent. It is far easier to consider sounds as conditionally produced, rising and passing in perception. I don't think of sounds as substantially existing, in the same way as I might for objects. Yeah, I thought this was a very useful and helpful observation. And I think there's really a point of learning to see through visual objects, to bring that understanding which we also have from modern physics of the basic insubstantiality of material objects. They are being made up for the most part just of space, and out of the mind constructing things as substantially existing, to bring that into seeing is a very fascinating challenge. And Dylan, the imagery of a donkey dragging a wagon, pushed by aversion to be goaded and pulled by craving for a carrot, helps illustrate the predicament of an ordinary mind. Pushed and pulled by defilements, ignorant of the fact that name and form is something reflected on consciousness, that provides a useful picture of the tangle within and the tangle without. And Jeff Hardin, as to our propensity to be like a donkey driven by a carrot and a stick, it comes down to the basic biology hardwired into even the primitive one-cell amoeba. The organism is attracted towards sugar media and away from salt. Without either stimulus, it either remains sedentary or wanders aimlessly in pursuit of the next stimulus. This is such a fundamental aspect of how the mind works that our practice truly is like swimming against the stream. Here it is indeed swimming against the stream. But maybe if we can play a little bit with that carrot simile, it could also be a matter of taking a very conscious decision of which direction we place the carrot. In the sense that the mind's inbuilt tendency to go after pleasure can be used for progress on the path. By placing the carrot of joy and happiness within the context of what is wholesome, and then allowing that amoeba, since amoeba's stage inbuilt tendency of the mind to go after pleasure, to lead in the direction of liberation. The intentional cultivation of wholesome forms of joy and happiness is an integral part of the path. From the rejoicing in even the elementary basics of ethical conduct, all the way up to the joy of the awakening factors and the deep happiness and bliss of absorption attainment. Nice carrot. That was all for the last forms discussion, and now we are into sermon number 11. Etang santam, etang panitam, yadidam sabbasankhara samato, sab upadipati nissaggo, tanha kayo virago nirodo nippanam. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely, the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the most venerable great preceptor, and the assembly of the venerable meditative monks, this is the 11th sermon in the series of sermons on Nibbana. In our last sermon, we tried to explain that contact arises dependent on name and form, because form gets a verbal impression by the naming quality in name, and name gets a resistance impression by the striking quality in form. In the context of this Dhamma, contact, properly so called, is a combination of these two, namely verbal impression and resistance impression. We also happened to mention the other day a new etymological explanation given by the Buddha for the word rupa, quoting the relevant passage from the Kajaniya Sutta of the Khanda Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. He has defined the form group with reference to affectation. Rupati diko bhikkave tasma rupanti vuccati. It is affected, monks. That is why it is called form. By what is it affected? By cold, heat, hunger, thirst, and the sting of gadflies, mosquitoes, and the like. While analyzing the implications of this being affected, we mentioned that the form group could be compared to a wound. According to the commentarial exegesis, too, rupati means to be adversely affected, to be afflicted, to come into conflict with, to be diseased and displeased. These are reminiscent of the responses usually associated with the person who has an easy, lacerable wound. To say that a patiga sampasa arises because of this lacerable quality is therefore very apt. The primary sense of the word patiga is striking against. Perception of form arises as a result of an attempt to understand through the factors on the name side this particular striking against, which resembles the laceration of a wound. This perception of form, which follows in the wake of the feeling that arises when something strikes against form, is like the groping of a blind man in the dark. Generally, the worldling is in the habit of staring at the form that comes within his grasp to ascertain its true nature. Likewise, he touches the form he sees with his eyes to verify it. As the saying goes, seeing is believing, but touch is the real thing. But both these attempts are like the gropings of a blind man. The worldling is unable to get rid of his delusion completely by either of these methods. It is because he is accustomed to draw conclusions under the influence of his perception of the compact, Ghanasanya. The fact that the two extreme views of existence and non-existence are also the outcome of his perception of the compact in regard to form is borne out by the following two lines of the verse we quoted from the Kalahavivada Sutta in our previous sermon. Rupesudisva vibhavang bhavancha vinichayam kurute njandaloke. Having seen the existence and destruction of material forms, a man in this world comes to a conclusion. The worldling has the idea that material forms have an absolute existence. This idea is the result of his perception of form. It is a perception arising out of his impression of it striking against. Whatever the level of this perception of form be, it is not better than the impression of a blind man. The two extreme views of absolute existence and non-existence in the world are based on this kind of impression. Various types of views and opinions current in the world regarding material forms and matter in general are the outcome of the notion that they are absolutely real. There is a tendency in the worldling to presume that what he grasps with his hands and sees with his eyes exists absolutely. So a thing is said to exist for some length of time before it gets destroyed. The logical conclusion, then, is that all things in the world exist absolutely and that at some point of time they get absolutely destroyed. This is how the two extreme views of absolute existence and absolute non-existence have arisen in this world. This is the outcome of a perception of form, which is tantamount to a pursuit of a mirage. It is an illusion. The Buddha has declared in the Jataka Sutta that where name and form, as well as resistance and perception of form, are cut off and cease, there the entire samsaric problem, which amounts to a tangle within and a tangle without, is also conclusively solved. That this is so could be inferred to some extent from what we have discussed so far. Nama and Rupa, as well as Patiga and Rupa Samya, are highly significant terms. Patiga and Rupa Samya are equivalent to Patiga Sampasa and Adivachana Sampasa, respectively. Now, as to this perception of form, it is basically conditioned by contact. That is why the Kalahavivada Sutta states that contact is the cause of the two views of existence and non-existence. In this Kalahavivada Sutta, one finds a series of questions and answers going deeper and deeper into the analysis of contact, step by step. The question, Passo nullo kasmin kuto nidano, what is the cause of contact in this world? Gets the answer, Namanche Rupanche Patichabhasu. Dependent on name and form is contact. The next question is, Kisming Vibhute Naphusanti Bhasa. In the absence of what do contacts not bring about contact, or touches do not touch? It gets the answer, Rupe Vibhute Naphusanti Bhasa. In the absence of form, contacts do not bring about contact. The question that comes up next, and the answer given, are extremely important. They lead to a deep analysis of the Dhamma, so much so that both verses deserve to be quoted in full. The question is, Katang sametasya vibhoti rupang sukang dukhang vapi katang vibhoti etam yapabruhi yatha vibhoti tang janiyama iti me manuahu. To one constituted in which manner does form cease to exist? Or how even pleasure and pain cease to exist? Do tell me how all these become non-existent. Let us know this, such a thought arose in me. The answer to this question is couched in this extraordinary verse. Nasanya sanyi, navisanya sanyi, nopya sanyi, navibhote sanyi, evam sametasya vibhoti rupam sanya nidanahi papancha sankha. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi of these two verses. How must one attain for form to vanish? How do pleasure and pain also vanish? Please tell me this, how they vanish. We would like to know that. Such is my thought. Not percipient through perception. Not percipient through disturbed perception. Not altogether without perception. Not percipient of what has vanished. Form vanishes for one who has so attained. For concepts due to proliferation are based on perception. And here is the Chinese parallel. And there's a translation by Bhapat. But I found that translation not to be sufficiently close to the original, so I ventured to give my own translation with some hesitation, because this text, Taisho entry 198, is by a translator with which I'm not so familiar, and so I'm not entirely sure. So this is just an attempt at translation, should not be taken as the final word. Not percipient of a perception, nor with perception of form, neither impercipient, nor with active perception. One gives up all perceptions without attachment, because perception is the root of the drama that follows dukkha. End of comment. What this verse purports to describe is the state of a person for whom form, as also pleasure and pain, has ceased to exist. He is not one with normal perception, nor is he one with abnormal perception. He is not non-percipient, nor has he rescinded perception. It is the one constituted in this manner that form ceases to exist, for papancha sangha, whatever they may be, have perception as their source. The meaning of this verse needs to be clarified further. According to the Mahanidesa, the allusion in this verse is to one who is on the path to the formless realms, having attained the first four absorptions. The commentary is forced to that conclusion, because it takes the phrase navibhuta sanyi as negating formless realms as such. The assumption is that the person referred to is neither conscious with normal perception, nor abnormally conscious, nor devoid of perception, as in the attainment of cessation, nor in one of the formless attainments. So then the only possibility seemed to be to identify it with some intermediate state. That is why the Mahanidesa and the other commentaries interpret this problematic state as that of one who is on the path to formless attainments, arupa manga samangi. However, considerations of context and presentation would lead to a different conclusion. The extraordinary state alluded to by this verse seems to be a supramundane one, which goes far deeper than the so-called intermediate state. The transcendence of form indicated here is more radical than the transcendence in attaining to formless states. Comment. Yeah, I support of Venerable Jnanananda's interpretation. I thought it's helpful if we look at the verses that come before. And I'm giving the Pali and the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Pasanidanam satang asatang pasya santina bhavanti hete vibhavang bhavanchapi yametamattang etam tipabhrumi ittu nidanam. The pleasant and unpleasant originate from contact. When contact does not exist, these do not come to be. As to this matter of vanishing and coming to be, I tell you that it originates from this. Yeah, vanishing, coming to be, I would have translated this as existence and non-existence. And so I think already this passage on the non-existence of contact and the question of vibhava and bhava makes it fairly clear that the topic at stage, at question, is quite a profound one. It is, and really only one would expect the Buddha to lead the discussion up to Nibbana and not to an intermediate stage before attaining an immaterial sphere or even an immaterial sphere, because this is not outside of the range of contact and also not outside of the duality between existence and non-existence. Next then is Paso nulo kasmin kutoni dano parigaha chapi kutupahuta kisming asantena mamatta mati kisming vibhutena pusanti pasam. This is the next question. From what in the world does contact originate? From what do possessions to arise? When what does not exist, is there no taking as mine? When what has vanished, do contacts not touch one? Here again, I think, again, the question of no context, and even more importantly, that there is no mamatta, no taking as mine. And this is really, this really requires leading up to the experience of Nibbana. Namancha rupancha paticca passa iccha nidanani parigghani iccha santyana mamattamati rupe vibhutina pusanti passa. Contacts are dependent upon name and form. Possessions are based on desire. When desire does not exist, there is no taking as mine. When form has vanished, contacts do not touch one. So again, freedom from desire, not taking as mine, they really point to the final goal. And the shift from nama-rupa in the first part to just rupa in the final part gives a little bit the impression that when we have this rupa-vibhuti, when form has vanished, that is actually a shortened reference to nama-rupa-vibhuti, that the question at stake is where to go to the vanishing of name and form, not just of form. And that is just because of the verse and the meter and the syllable count that it's not, we don't get the full term. Anyway, this is just my interpretation, and I just wanted to look at the previous verses that eventually lead up to the Nasanya Sanya verse in support of the understanding and interpretation by Venerable Jnanananda, that Nasanya, Sanyi, etc. must be referring to experience related to awakening, to Nibbana, because that is where contact ceases, where one gets out of mind-making and eye-making, etc. End of comment. It is a transcendence at a supramundane level, as we may well infer from the last line of the verse, Sanya Nidana hi papancha sankha. Papancha Sankhara is a term which has a relevance to insight meditation, and the denouement of the sutta is also suggestive of such a background. The Kala Vivada Sutta, consisting of 16 verses, is from beginning to end a network of deep questions and answers leading to levels of insight. The opening verse, for instance, states the initial problem as follows. Kuto pauta kalaha vivada parideva sukha samacharacha manati mana sahapesunacha kuto pauta tidalinga bruhi. Whence to spring up contentions and disputes, lamentations, sorrows and envies, and arrogance together with slander? Whence do they spring up? Pray tell me this. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. From where do quarrels and disputes arise? Lamentation, sorrow and miserliness. Conceit and arrogance along with slander. From where do they arise? Please tell me this. End of comment. It is in answer to this basic question that this discourse gradually unfolds itself. In accordance with the law of dependent arising, the cause of contentions and disputes is said to be the tendency to hold things dear. Piya pauta kalaha vibhata. Then the question is about the cause of this idea of holding things dear. The cause of it is said to be desire. Chanda nidanani piyani loke. Things dear originate from desire. Desire or interest makes things dear. The next question is, what is the origin of desire? Desire is traced to the distinction between the pleasant and the unpleasant. It is in reply to the question regarding the origin of this distinction between the pleasant and the unpleasant that contact is brought in. In fact, it is the question as to the origin of contact, passo nullo cosmin kuto nidano, which formed the starting point of our discussion. The answer to that question is name and form, namancha rupancha. So in this chain of causes, the link that comes next to contact is name and form. Now the verse in question, beginning with na sanya sanyi, goes deeper than name and form. Even the question about contact has a peculiar wording, kismin vibhute na bhusanti passa, when what is not there do touch is not touch. The question then is not just the cessation of contact as such. The answer too has the same peculiarity. Rupa vibhuti na bhusanti passa. It is when form is not there that touches do not touch. It is the subsequent question regarding form that brings out the cryptic verse as the answer. All this goes to show that the verse in question alludes to a supramundane state, far transcending the formless or any supposed intermediate stage. The transcendence of pleasure and pain, as well as perception of form, is implied here. The verse beginning with Nasanya Sanyi brings the entire analytical disquisition to a climax. It comes as the 13th verse in the series. Usually, such a disquisition leads up to a climax, highlighting Nibbana. It is obvious, therefore, that the reference here is to the Nibbanic mind. We have here four negations. Nasanya Sanyi, Navisanya Sanyi, Nopiya Sanyi, Navibhuta Sanyi. These four negations insinuate a strange supramundane level of perception. In short, it is an attempt to analyze the crux of the Dhamma in terms of perception. As to the provocation for such an approach, we may remind ourselves of the fact that, according to the Buddha, release from materiality amounted to a release from the perception of form. Here we have something really deep. As it was stated in the Jatasutta, for the disentangling of the tangle, name and form, resistance and perception of form have to be cut off. This last mentioned perception of form, Rupa Sanya, is highly significant. Before the advent of the Buddha, the general belief, even among ascetics, was that in order to be free from form, one has to attain to the formless, arupa. But, as we pointed out in an earlier sermon, this kind of approach to the question of freedom from form is like the attempt of one who, having imagined a ghost in the darkness of the night, runs away to escape it. He is simply taking the fantasy of the ghost with him. Likewise, perception of form is already implicit in the formless. What has been done is only a pushing away of the perception of form with the help of sankharas. It is merely a suppression of form through the power of absorption. It does not amount to a cessation of the perception of form. What then is the message the Buddha gave to the world regarding the abandonment by way of eradication? He pointed out that freedom from form can be won only by comprehending a certain deep normative principle behind perception. Till then, one keeps on going round and round in samsara. Even if one breaks away from form to stay for eons in formless realms, one swings back to form at the end of that period. Why? Because the ghost of form still haunts the formless. It is precisely because of this fact that pre-Buddhistic ascetics could not free themselves from the round of existence. The Kalahavivada Sutta as a whole could be regarded as an extremely deep analysis of the basis of the two views of existence and non-existence. Our departure from the Mahanidesa in regard to the interpretation of this discourse might sometimes be called in question, but let the wise judge its reasonableness on its own merits. According to our interpretation so far, the 13th verse marks the climax of the discourse with its allusion to Nibbana. This is obvious from the 14th verse, in which the questioner confesses, Yantang apuchima akitayino anyantang puchamata dinga bruhi. Whatever we have asked you, that you have explained to us. Now we wish to ask you something else. Pray, give us an answer to that too. Comment, a translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. You explain to us whatever we asked you. Let us now ask something else. Please tell me this. In his annotation to his forthcoming Sutta Nipata translation, Bhikkhu Bodhi reasons that he also disagrees with the commentary interpretation that the verse Nasanyasani refers to the intermediate stage between the fourth absorption and the attainment of the sphere of infinite space. And he instead suggests that there may be a relationship to the attainment of neither perception nor non-perception. I found this a very interesting idea, and so my present stage of understanding of Kalahavivada Sutta, which is certainly not final, I think that Vanumanyanananda is probably right that the Nasanyasani verse does refer to Nibbana. But what comes next, when the questioner says, I'm going to ask something else, and he brings in the idea of a self, I think that the questioner probably misunderstood that and would have taken that verse to refer to neither perception or non-perception. So that is the way I make sense of it, out of the whole discourse. To just summarize it in brief, the basic question about where this quarreling start from leads via several conditions finally to the state of Nibbana, as that where contacts and mind-making cease. But the cryptic reference to Nibbana is misunderstood by the question to be a reference of neither perception or non-perception. Therefore, he asks the next question, to which we will now come. That is just my take on the sutta. End of comment. The questioner posed is this: Etavat agangnuva danti heke yakngasa suddingida panditase udavanyang pivadanti etto. To some who are reckoned as wise men here, declare the highest purity of the soul with this much alone, or else to deposit something else beyond this. The interlocutor is trying to get the solution restated in terms of the two views of existence and non-existence. The term yakka is used in this context in the sense of an individual soul. it betrays an assumption based on wrong view. The question concerns the purity of the individual soul. The interlocutor wants to ascertain whether wise men in the world declare this state as the highest purity of the soul, or whether they go beyond this in postulating something more. Here is an attempt to get the answer already given restated in terms of the soul theory, a sort of anticlimax. The two concluding verses that follow give the lie to this presumptuous question. Etavat aggam pi vadanti he ke yakam kassa suddin ila panditase tesam paneke samayam vadanti anupari sese kusala vadana. Some who are regarded as wise men here call this itself the highest purity of the individual soul. But there again some among them who speak of an annihilation, claiming to be experts in the cessation without residue. Ete chanyatva upanisitati, nyatva muni nisayesa vimansi, nyatva vimuttam vimutto navivadameti, bhava bhavaya nasameti dhiru. Knowing that they are dependent on speculative views, the sage with discernment with regard to whatever is speculative, emancipated as he is through understanding, does not enter into dispute. A truly wise man does not fall back either on existence or non-existence. Comment. Translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Some wise men here say at this point that this is the foremost purity of the spirit. But some among them speak of an attainment, claiming to be skilled in that without residue remaining. Having known these to be dependent, and having known the dependencies, the Muni, the investigator, having known liberated, does not enter disputes. The wise one does not come upon various states of existence. And the last line is informed by the commentary, the Paramattha Jyotika, which understands bhava bhavaya nasameti to mean the realizing. The word sameti itself, I have given here in the Pali English dictionary, has nuances of come together, meet, assemble, associate with, go to, correspond to, agree, know, consider, and fit in. And I'm giving here three passages where it has this sense of agreeing. The first one from the Digha Nikaya, where the Buddha says that about certain bhikkhus and brahmins that with certain things he agrees and with other things he disagrees. And the statement from the Majjhima Nikaya that the meaning could be different and the expression could be in agreement, or the meaning could be in agreement and the expression could be different. And in the Anguttara Nikaya, somebody who says that what Buddha has just said, that he is in agreement with between the Buddha and himself. So just to come back to the translation of this verse, I think even though does not fall back is a somewhat free rendering, but I think it brings out the sense. And I would also personally prefer to have existence and non-existence for Bhavaya here. And in the previous verse for Samaya, Tesam Paneka Samayam Vadanti, I would just think the sense that it is something temporary would be appropriate. So, this is the Kalavivada is a challenge, and these verses are also not easy. But what I would understand, according to the interpretation I mentioned before, is that, like in the first two lines, itavatatagam pivadanti heke yakasa suding ida panitasi, the Buddha is just repeating what the questioner has said. And then that those who speak with expertise in non-attachment, they would call this just a temporary thing. And on the understanding that this is the neither perception or non-perception, this would be quite a fitting thing. It's just a temporary thing. And then the last verse, then knowing what they are dependent on and investigating the dependency and being liberated and not going into disputes. The wise does not agree or go along with either existence or non-existence. Anyhow, that is just my attempt to make sense out of that sutta. End of comment. The concluding verse amounts to a refutation of both these extreme views. The truly wise sage who is released with proper discernment of the nature of dogmatic involvement has no disputes with those who are at loggerheads with each other on the issue of existence and non-existence. This in effect means that Nibbana is goal avoids both extremes of eternalism and nihilism. On this I find a very important statement, and it is something to which I like to come back at the end of the lecture. End of comment. The Upasīva Sutta in the Parayanavāga of the Sutta Nipāta provides further proof of the plausibility of the above interpretation. There, Nibbāna as the cessation of consciousness in the Arahant is compared to the extinction of a flame. Acciyata vata vigena kitto atantang paleti na upeti saṅkhaṁ evaṁ mūni namakkāya vimutto atantang paleti na upeti saṅkhaṁ. This flame flung on by a force of wind reaches its end, comes not within reckoning. So the sage, released from name and form, reaches its end, comes not within reckoning. Common translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. As flame thrown by a gust of wind, Upasīva, said the Blessed One, goes out and cannot be designated, so the Muni, liberated from the mental body, goes out and cannot be designated. End of comment. When a flame goes out, it cannot be reckoned as having gone in any of the directions, like north, east, south, and west. All that can be said about it is that it has gone out. Even after the Buddha has given this reply, the Brahmin youth Upasīva, entrenched as he is in the eternalist view, raises a question which is similar to the one already quoted. A comment already quoted, I think the reference is to the Yakkasasudhi question in the Kalavivada Sutta. End of comment. He too is trying to understand in terms of the two extreme views of existence and non-existence. Antangato sudavasu natti udavve sasatiyarugo tangmi muni sadhu viyakaruhi tathayate virito esa dhammo. Has he reached his end, or is he no more, or is he eternally well? That to me, sage, in full explain. For this Dhamma is well within your ken. Comment. Translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. But does one who has gone out not exist, or else is he healthy through eternity? Explain this matter clearly to me, O Muni, for this Dhamma has been understood by you. And I am also adding the next verse in Pali and with Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, because I think it helps to have the entire context well in mind. Atantangatasana pamanamatti upasivati bhagavan yenanang vajju tantasanatti sabvesu dhammesu sammuhatesu sammuhata vadapathapi sabve. There is no measure of one who has gone out, Upasīva, said the Blessed One. There is no means by which they might speak of him. When all phenomena have been uprooted, all pathways of speech are also uprooted. Yeah, I find this verse particularly significant, and that it shows that, to my mind, that much of the controversy around Nibbana is due to trying to grasp in terms of language something that is in principle beyond language. That's a topic I will also come back to at the end of the lecture. End of comment. In the discourses, we find similar instances of attempts to determine, in terms of those two extreme views, even a conclusive statement of the Buddha on the question of Nibbana. Yet another instance is found in the Pottapada Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. There the Buddha outlines the path to Nibbana from the point of view of perception. The discourse, therefore, is one that highlights the importance of the term sannyā. In that discourse, the path of training leading to Nibbana is introduced under the heading Anupubhavi Sannyā Nirodha Sampajana Samāpatti, the attainment with full awareness to the gradual cessation of higher levels of perception. What is significant in this particular context is that the invitation for this exposition came from the ascetics of other sects. In response to their request to enlighten them on the subject of the cessation of higher levels of perception, Abhisanya Nirodha, the Buddha gave quite a long account of the course of training required for it. But at the end of that deep exposition, the wandering ascetic Pottapada raises the following question. Sanya nukho purisasa atta udahu anya sanya anya atta. Is perception a man's soul, or is perception something and soul another? This is typical of their bigoted attitude, which prevented them from understanding this Dhamma free from the soul prejudice. We went so far as to bring out all this evidence, because the point at issue is fairly important. Even the attempt of the Mahanidesa to explain the verse beginning with Nasanya Sanyi is far from conclusive. It is not at all likely that the ascetics of other sects subscribed to a view that the intermediate stage between the fourth absorption and the first formless absorption is equivalent to the purest state of the soul. Such an interim state is of no account. As we go on, we might come across further proof of the tenability of this interpretation. The verse beginning with Nasanya Sanyi is not easily forgotten because of its unusual accent on the negative particle. We might have to hark back to it when we come across similar discourses dealing with Nibbana. Till then, let us remind ourselves of two similes we have already given in order to get a foretaste of the significance of this problematic verse. Firstly, the Buddha's simile of the magic show as an illustration for consciousness in the Penapindupama Sutta, Mayopamancha Vinyana. While describing the five groups, he compares consciousness to a magical performance at crossroads conducted by a magician or his apprentice. A man with the right type of vision watching this magic show understands that it is empty, hollow, and void of essence. It is as if he has seen through the tricks and deceptions of the magician. While watching a magic show, the audience in general reacts to it with gaping mouths and exclamations. But how would a man with radical attention and penetrative wisdom, who is fully aware of the tricks of the magician, watch a magic show? He is simply looking on with a vacant gaze. This reminds us of the significance of the word Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sambhatupalam. The gaze is endless, anantam, in the sense that it does not have the magic show as its object. It goes beyond. It is also non-manifestative, anidassanam, since the magic show does not manifest itself, as it has now been penetrated through with wisdom. This wisdom is revealing in its all lustrous nature, Sambhatupabham, so much so that the tricks are seen through. So this man with discernment is watching with a vacant gaze. Now, how would such a person appear to one who is deluded and enchanted by the magic show? The latter might regard the former as an inattentive spectator who misses the magic show. Or else he might think that the other is out of his senses, or insensate. What the riddle verse beginning with Nasanya Sanyi refers to is such a vacant gaze. That is to say, the person referred to is not one with the ordinary worldling's perception, which is deluded, Nor has he fainted and become unconscious. Nasanya sanyi, navisanya sanyi. He is not in a trance, devoid of perception, nopya sanyi. Nor has he put an end to perception, navibhuta sanyi. What these four negations highlight is that vacant gaze of the one who is emancipated through wisdom. Comment, yeah, I think there's probably maybe a slight error that occurred in the oral presentation, but visanya-sanyi does not refer to being, to having fainted or becoming unconscious, but it has the sense of a distorted perception. End of comment. Somewhat on the lines of the simile used by the Buddha, we might reintroduce as a flashback the simile of the cinema. Though it has a modernistic flavor, it could perhaps be more easily understood. Let us suppose that a matinee show of a Technicolor film is in progress with closed doors and windows. Suddenly, by some technical defect, the doors and windows are flung open. What would be the change of perspective in the spectator now? He, too, would be looking on with a vacant gaze. Though still the show is going on, he is no longer seeing it. A sort of cessation has occurred, at least temporarily. The theme, as well as the object of all our sermons, is expressed in the quotation beginning with, "This is peaceful, this is excellent," etc., which forms the rubric, as it were, for each sermon. The change that occurs in the spectator now is somewhat reminiscent of it. Though not all preparations, at least those preparations connected with the film show are momentarily stilled. Whatever assets in the form of the bundle of experiences on which the film show is evaluated are relinquished. The craving or the desire for the show has gone down. The colorful show has faded away, making way for detachment. The film show has ceased for him. It is also extinct for him, since his burning desire has cooled off now. In this way, we can understand the four puzzling negations in that middle verse as an attempt to describe the vacant gaze of the spectator and that man with discernment at the magic show. Another aspect of special significance in this middle verse emerges from the last line, "Sanya nidana hi papancha sankha," which could be tentatively rendered as, "For whatever are termed papancha sankha, have perception as their source." Papancha is a term with a deep philosophical dimension in Buddhism. In fact, even the rise of many Buddhist sects could be put down to an insufficient appreciation of its significance. In our own philosophical tradition too, much of the confusion with regard to the interpretation of Nibbana seems to have come about due to a lack of understanding in this particular field. Therefore, we propose to devote sufficient time and attention to clarify the significance of this term, papancha. To begin with, we can bring up clear evidence of the fact that the word papancha is used in the discourses to convey some deep idea. As a rule, whenever the Buddha presents a set of ideas pertaining to some Dhamma topic, the deepest or the most important of them is mentioned last. This feature is quite evident in the Anguttara Nikaya, where very often a sermon is seen to unfold itself in an ascending order, leading to a climax. In an enumeration of items, the last, but not the least, happens to be the most important. Granted that this is the general trend, we can trace as many as 9 such contexts among the suttas in which papancha is counted last. This itself is a clue to its importance. One of the most telling instances is to be found in the 8th of the Anguttara Nikaya. It is called Anuruddha Mahavitakka Sutta. There we are told that to Venerable Anuruddha, once meditating in solitude in Pachinavangsa Park, the following 7 thoughts occurred concerning Dhamma. Apiccha sayang dhammo nayang dhamma maitchasa. Santutta sayang dhammo nayang dhamma santuttasa. pavitasayam dhammo nayam dhammo sanganikaramasa araddha viryasayam dhammo nayam dhammo kusitasa upatita satisayam dhammo nayam dhammo muttasattissa samayitasayam dhammo nayam dhammo samayitasa panyavato ayam dhammo nayam dhammo vipanyasa. This Dhamma is for one who wants little, not for one who wants much. This Dhamma is for one who is contented, not for one who is discontented. This Dhamma is for one who is secluded, not for one who is fond of society. This Dhamma is for the energetic, not for one who is lazy. This Dhamma is for one who has set up mindfulness, not for one who is laggard in mindfulness. This Dhamma is for one who is composed, not for one who is flustered. This Dhamma is for one who is wise, not for one who is unwise. Common translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. This Dhamma is for one with few desires, not for one with strong desires. This Dhamma is for one who is content, not for one who is not content. This Dhamma is for one who resorts to solitude, not for one who delights in company. This Dhamma is for one who is energetic, not for one who is lazy. This Dhamma is for one with mindfulness established, not for one who is muddle-minded. This Dhamma is for one who is concentrated, not for one who is unconcentrated. This Dhamma is for one who is wise, not for one who is unwise. When these seven thoughts occur to him, when Anuruddha kept on pondering over them for a long while, probably with some Dhamma zest, he might have even felt confident that this is a perfect set of Dhamma thoughts, since the number is seven and wisdom comes last. However, the Buddha was monitoring his behavior of mind from Besakalavani, many leagues away, and found that this set of seven is far from complete. So he appeared before Venerable Anuruddha through his psychic power and, having first commended Venerable Anuruddha for those seven thoughts, calling them thoughts of great men, Mahapurisa Vitakka, gave him an eighth to add onto them and ponder upon. The eighth thought of a great man is Nippapancha Ramasayang Dhamma Nippapancha Ratino Nayang Dhamma Pancha Ramasapapancha Ratino. This Dhamma is for one who likes and delights in Nippapancha, and not for one who likes and delights in Papancha. Comment translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. This Dhamma is for one who delights in non-proliferation, who takes delight in non-proliferation, not for one who delights in proliferation, who takes delight in proliferation. Following the Buddha's instruction in this concern, Venerable Anuruddha attained Arahanthood and uttered two verses as a paean of joy. From the two verses it becomes clear that the Buddha's helpful hint regarding Nippapancha, whatever it may be, whatever it may mean, was what triggered off his attainment. Yatame ahu sankappo tatto uttari desaye Nippapancha rato buddho Nippapancham adesaye Tassang dhammam manyayam vihasing sasanerato tisso vidyanupatta kattang buddhas sasanam. Whatever thoughts I had on my own, going far beyond them, the Lord preached to me. The Buddha, who delights in Nippapancha, preached Nippapancha to me. Understanding this dhamma, I dwelt delighting in his admonishment. The three knowledges are attained, done is the Buddha's behest. Common translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. He taught me more than my thoughts contained. The Buddha, delighting in non-proliferation, instructed me in non-proliferation. Having learned his Dhamma, I delighted in his teaching. I have gained three true knowledges. The Buddha's teaching has been done. So here is the relevant passage from the Madhyama Agama, and I'm beginning with the Buddha's reply to Anuruddha's reflection, where he repeats Anuruddha's thought and then adds the eighth one. It is well, Anurunga, that while seated in meditation in a quiet place reflecting, you have these seven thoughts. The path is attained through having no desires, not through having desires. The path is attained through contentment, not through dissatisfaction. The path is attained through seclusion, not through rejoicing in company, dwelling in company, being together with company. The path is attained through effort, not through indolence. The path is attained through right mindfulness, not through wrong mindfulness. The path is attained through a concentrated mind, not through a distracted mind. The path is attained through wisdom, not through delusion. Anuruddha, you shall receive from the Tathagata an eighth thought of a great man. Having received it, reflect on it. The path is attained through absence of proliferation, delighting in absence of proliferation and practicing absence of proliferation. Not through proliferation, not through delighting in proliferation, not through practicing proliferation. And then here also the verse by Anuruddha. He taught me regarding the seven thoughts in my mind and then added a further one. Namely, that all Buddhas delight in absence of proliferation, being far removed from any proliferation. Having come to know the Dharma from him, being happily established in the true Dharma, I attained concentration and penetrative wisdom. What was to be done in the Buddha's teaching has been done. And now I just wanted to make a by-the-side comment on an interesting difference among the parallels regarding the actual meeting. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Madhyama Agama, and also an individual translation, they all report that the Buddha arrived by supernormal means. And in the Anguttara Nikaya, specifically if we take into account also the Theragata verse by Venerable Anuruddha, it seems that the idea is that the Buddha created a mind-made body and came with that. But in an Ekotarika Agama parallel, actually Anuruddha had come to visit the Buddha, and I'm giving the Chinese here, which clearly implies that he simply walked up to the Buddha and paid his respect to him. And the passage is interesting in so far as it shows different stages in the development of the idea of how this meeting took place. And it helps to contextualize the idea of supernormal feats, in particular feats involving levitation. And in an article that I will make available on the forum, I have discussed this and come to the suggestion that the original idea behind levitation was the ability of a meditator to extract a mind-made body out of the physical body and travel with this mind-made body. So when we get descriptions like diving into water and walking on water, touching the sun and moon, visiting some devas, and even visiting, like the Buddha visiting Anuruddha, the idea would apparently have been in the beginning only that this was happening with the mental body. And it is only later literalism that would have led to an understanding that this is actually a physical act of levitation. End of comment. The words of Venerable Anuruddha clearly reveal the immense significance attached to the term papancha and its relevance to the question of attaining Nibbana. It is noteworthy that the number of suttas like Kalavivada Sutta, Sakkapanya Sutta, Chulasihanada Sutta, and Marupinika Sutta give prominence to the term papancha by listing it as the last. One of the most important discourses throwing light on the significance of this term papancha is the Marupinika Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. We shall therefore proceed to discuss this particular sutta at some length. The Marupinika Sutta is in fact a discourse that unfolds itself in three stages, like a three-act play. it might not be inapt to say something about the title of this discourse by way of introduction, before we get down to an analysis of it. Excuse me. At the conclusion of the discourse, Venerable Ananda makes the following comment on its significance before the Buddha. Lord, just as if a man overcome by hunger and exhaustion came upon a honey ball, and from whatever side he goes on licking it, so would get a sweet, delectable flavor, which remains unimpaired. So too, Lord, any nimble-witted monk, from whatever angle he examines with wisdom the meaning of this discourse on the Dhamma, he would find satisfaction and gladness of mind. What is the name of this discourse, Lord? It was then that the Buddha gave this name to the discourse, saying, well then, Ananda, you may remember this discourse on the Dhamma as the honey ball discourse. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi of Ananda's statement. Venerable Sir, just as if a man exhausted by hunger and weakness came upon a honey ball, wherever he would taste it, he would find a sweet, delectable flavor. So too, Venerable Sir, any able-minded bhikkhu, wherever he might scrutinize with wisdom the meaning of this discourse on the Dhamma, would find satisfaction and confidence of mind. Venerable Sir, what is the name of this discourse on the Dhamma? And here also the Madhyama Agama version, where it is the Buddha who comes out with the honey ball simile. Monks, it is as if someone, because of dwelling in a secluded place, in the mountains or a forest, were to suddenly obtain a ball of honey. Whichever part of it he eats, he gets the taste of it. In the same way, a clansman in my true dharma and discipline, whichever part of it he contemplates, he gets the taste of it. Contemplating the eyes, he gets the taste. Contemplating the ears, nose, tongue, body. Contemplating the mind, he gets the taste. Yeah, I particularly like the nuance brought out by the Madhyama Agama simile, which to my mind enriches the simile of the honey ball. That this ball of honey is sweet wherever one bites into it, wherever one tastes it. And so this analysis of the six sense spheres presented in Madhupinika Sutta can lead to the taste of liberation, the taste of the Dharma, by being applied to any of the sense doors. It doesn't matter which one chooses, as long as one gets that penetrative insight through that sense door process. End of comment. We might not have the ability to assimilate fully the flavor of this discourse, and in any case, we might not even have sufficient time for it today. However, if we are to make a start, we may begin with the first act, that is, where we find the Buddha spending his noonday siesta at Mahavan in Kapilavastu. So the Sakyan Dandapani, so-called because he used to carry a staff in hand, comes to see the Buddha and puts the following short question to him. King Vali Samano, King Akkai, what does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim? Comment, yeah, this is obviously somewhat challenging, and we may assume that Sakyantanapani was unhappy that a member of his family had become a recluse, and so the way he asked it is rather impolite and challenging. End of comment. The Buddha's reply to it is rather long and winding, so much so that it is not easy to render it clear enough. Yattha variko avoso sadeva ke loke samarake sa brahma ke sasamana brahmani apajaya sadeva manusaya na kenachi loke vigaya dittati yattha chapana kame visangyuttam viharantam tang brahmanam akatankatin Chinna kukkuchang bhava bhavevi titanham sanyananu senti evam valikvang avo sivan akkhai. According to whatever doctrine, friend, one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its maras and brahmas, with the progeny of the world comprising recluses and brahmins, gods and men, and also due to which perceptions no more underlie that Brahmin who abides detached from sense pleasures, without perplexity, remorse cut off, and devoid of craving for any kind of existence. Such is my doctrine, friend, and thus do I proclaim it. Common translation by Nyanamoni. Friend, I assert and proclaim my teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world with its gods, its malas, and its brahmas. In this generation, with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people, in such a way that perceptions no more underlie that brahmin, who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being. Enter Madhyama Agama parallel. Sakyan, my teaching is not to quarrel with anyone in the entire world. Devas, malas, brahmas, renunciants and brahmins, from human beings to devas. To practice the pure holy life, secluded from sensual desires, abandon hypocrisy, cut off worries, and not be attached to existence, non-existence or non-perception. This is the basis of my dispensation. This is what I teach. End of comment. It must be noted that the word Brahmin in this context refers to the Arahant. The reply, winding as it is, goes deeper in its insinuations, touching the presumptions of the questioner. That is to say, generally, in the world, if anyone proclaims a doctrine, it is natural that it will come into contact with other doctrines. Also, in proclaiming that doctrine, one has to have latent perceptions relating to it. The Buddha's reply, however, seems to contradict these presumptions. In a nutshell, the reply amounts to this. Firstly, the Buddha's teaching is such that he does not come into conflict with others. Secondly, perceptions do not lie latent in him. The occurrence of the term sannya, perception, in this context is also significant. We have already stressed the importance of this term. Perceptions do not lie latent in the Buddha or in the doctrine propounded by him. Dandapani's response to this reply of the Buddha is also recorded in the sutta. It is dramatic enough to substantiate our comparison of the discourse to a three-act play. Dandapani shook his head, wagged his tongue, raised his eyebrows into a three-lined frown on his forehead and departed, leaning on his stick. The Buddha's reply did not arouse any faith in him. In the next act, we find the Buddha seated in the company of the monks in the evening and telling them of his brief encounter with Dandapani. Then one of the monks requested an explanation of the enigmatic reply the Buddha had given to Dandapani. The Buddha's explanation, however, took the form of an even longer statement, no less enigmatic than the former. It runs, Yato nidānaṁ bhikkhu purīsampa pañca sanya saṅkha samudācharanti etntāce natnti abhinanditabhaṁ abhivaditabhaṁ ajyositabhaṁ ese vantu rāganu sayānaṁ ese vantu patigānu sayānaṁ ese vantu dittānu sayānaṁ ese vantu vichikicchānu sayānaṁ ese vantu mānānu sayānaṁ ese vantu bhavarāganu sayānaṁ ese vantu avijjānu sayānaṁ Esevanto danda dana satta dana kalaha vingaha vivara tuvantuva pesunya musava dana etteti papaka kusala dhamma aparisisa niruddhanti. From whatever source papanja sanya sangha be said a man, if in regard to that there's nothing to be delighted in, asserted or clung to, then this itself is the end of the underlying tendencies to attachment, to aversion, to views, to doubts, to conceits, to attachment towards existence and to ignorance. This itself is the end of taking rods and weapons, quarrels, disputes, accusations, slander and false speech. Here these evil, unskillful states cease without remainder. Comment, translation by Nyanamoni. Because as to the thoughts through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. And the Madhyama Agama version. Monks suppose that the person with the corresponding reflection as the cause leaves the household life to train in the path. With intention and perception he practices not desiring past, future and present phenomena, not rejoicing in them, not becoming attached to them and not dwelling on them. This is called the end of dukkha, namely the end of the underlying tendency to desire, the underlying tendency to hatred, the underlying tendency to existence, the underlying tendency to conceit, the underlying tendency to ignorance, the underlying tendency to views, and the underlying tendency to doubt. This is called the end of quarrel, resentment, flattery, deceit, false speech, divisive speech, and innumerable evil and unwholesome states. This is called the end of dukkha. Yeah, my personal impression is that the Madhyama Agama, there's something has gone wrong either in the transmission or in the translation here. It has some elements that still correspond to what we find in the Pali, but the other parts are a little bit strange sometimes. Anyway, end of comment. After making such a long and winding statement, the Buddha rose from his seat and went into his dwelling, as if it were the end of the second act. One can well imagine the consternation of the monks at this dramatic turn of events. The explanation looked even more astounding than the original statement, because of its elliptical character. So here is a case of a puzzle within a puzzle. It is the first few words that are most puzzling. Naturally, the monks were so perplexed that they decided to approach Venerable Mahakacchana and request him to give them a detailed exposition of the Buddha's words, as he had been praised by the Buddha for his skill in this respect. When they went to him and made the request, Venerable Mahakacchana showed some modest hesitation at first, but finally agreed to it. Now we come to the third act, in which Venerable Mahakacchana is giving the exposition. Chakuncha vunsa paticca rupa cha upanjadi chakku vinyanam tinnang sangati phasu phasa paccaya vidana yang vidyeti tang sanjanati yang sanjanati tang vitakketi yang vitakketi tang papancheti yang papancheti tato nidanam purisam papancha sanya sanka samudacharanti atita nagata pachupannesu chakku vinyayesu rupesu. Not only with regard to iron forms, but also with reference to all the other sense faculties, including the mind, together with their respective sense objects, a similar statement is made. Suffice it to translate the one quoted above as a paradigm. Depending on the iron forms, brethren, arises eye consciousness. The concurrence of the three is contact. Because of contact, feeling, what one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, one reasons about. What one reasons about, one turns into papancha. What one turns into papancha, owing to that, tatanidhanam, which is the correlative of yatanidhanam, forming the key word in the Buddhist brief somewhere above. Papancha sanya sanka beset him who directed his power of sense perception. They overwhelm him and subjugate him in regard to forms cognizable by the eye belonging to the past, the future, and the present. Comment, translation by Nyanamoli. Depending on the iron forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to past, future and present forms cognizable through the eye. Enter Madhyama Agama version. Venerable friends, independence on the iron forms, I consciousness arises. The coming together of these three things is contact. Independence on contact, there's feeling. If there's feeling, there's perception. If there's perception, there's intention. If there's intention, there's thought. If there's thought, there's differentiation. A monk, having gone forth to train in the path with such a corresponding reflection as the cause, with intention and perception, practices not desiring past, future and present phenomena, not rejoicing in them, not becoming attached to them, and not dwelling on them. End of comment. It is the same with regard to the ear and sounds and the rest. Lastly, even about mind and mind objects, Venerable Mahakachana makes a similar statement. At this point, we are forced to say something about the commentarial explanation of this particular passage. It seems that the commentarial exegesis has failed to bring out the deeper implications of the term papañca-sannyasaṅkhāra. The main reason for the confusion is the lack of attention on the part of the commentator to the peculiar syntax of the formula in question. The formula begins on an impersonal note, cakuncha vusa paticca rupe ca upajjati cakkhu viññāna. The word paticca is reminiscent of the law of dependent arising. Tinnam sangati passum, the concurrence of the three is contact. Passa paccaya vedana, conditioned by contact is feeling. From here onwards, the formula takes a different turn. Yang vedeti tang sanjanati, yang sanjanati tang vitakketi, yang vitakketi tang papancheti. What one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, one reasons about. What one reasons about, one turns into papancha. In this way, we can distinguish three phases in this description of the process of sense perception in Venerable Mahakachana's exposition. It begins with an impersonal note, but at the point of feeling, it takes on a personal ending, suggestive of deliberate activity. Yang videti tang sanjanati, yang sanjanati tang vitakketi, yang vitakketi tang papancheti. What one feels, one perceives, what one perceives, one reasons about, what one reasons about, one turns into papancha. Though we render the formula in this way, the commentary explains it differently. It ignores the significance of the personal ending and interprets the sensory process periphrastically. For example, as sanya sanjanati, vitakko vitakketi, perception perceives, reasoning reasons about, etc. It amounts to saying that when feeling occurs, perception comes forward and perceives it, then reasoning takes up the task of reasoning about perception. Papancha then steps in and converts that reasoning into papancha. This is how the commentary explains that formula. It has left out of account the significance of the use of the active voice in this section of the formula. There is a special purpose in using the active voice in this context. It is in order to explain how a man is overwhelmed by papancha sanyasanka, whatever it may be, that Venerable Mahakachana has introduced this sequence of events in three phases. In fact, he is trying to fill in the gap in the rather elliptical statement of the Buddha, beginning with Yato nidanam bhikkhu purisam papancha sanyasanka samudacharanti. Monk, from whatever source papancha sanyasanka be said to man. The initial phase is impersonal, but then comes the phase of active participation. From feeling onwards, the person behind it takes over. What one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, one reasons about. What one reasons about, one turns into papancha. The grossest phase is the third. Venerable Mahakachana's formula shows how the process of sense perception gradually assumes a gross form. This third phase is implicit in the words yang papancheti tatunidanam purisam papancha sanyasanka samudacharanti. What one turns into papancha, owing to that papancha sanyasanka be said that man. The word purisang is in the accusative case here, implying that the person who directed sense perception is now beset with or overwhelmed by papancha sanyasankara. as a result of which all the evil, unskillful states come to be. This itself is an index to the importance of the term papancha. The course of events suggested by these three phases may be illustrated with the legend of the three magicians. While journeying through a forest, three men, skilled in magic, came upon a scattered heap of bones of a tiger. To display their skill, one of them converted the bones into a complete skeleton, the second gave it flesh and blood, and the third gave it life. The resurrected tiger devoured all three of them. It is such a predicament that is hinted at by the peculiar syntax of the formula in question. The comparison of this discourse to a honey ball is understandable, since it holds the secret of the latent tendencies towards dogmatic views. It also affords a deep insight into the nature of the linguistic medium and words and concepts in everyday usage. We haven't yet clarified the meaning of the term papancha. It is already found in common parlance as a word suggestive of verbosity in circumlocution. Etymologically, it is traceable to pra and punch, and it conveys such meanings as spreading out, expansion, diffuseness, and manifoldness. Verbosity and circumlocution usually lead to delusion and confusion. However, the word papancha is sometimes used to denote a conscious elaboration of what is already expressed in brief. In this particular sense, the cognate term vipanchitanyu is used in the context of four types of person, distinguished according to their levels of understanding, namely upangatitanyu, vipanchitanyu, neyu, and paraparamo. Here, vipanchitanyu signifies that sort of person to whom comprehension of the doctrine comes when the meaning of what is uttered in brief is analyzed in detail. All in all, papancha in linguistic usage as the insinuation of a certain degree of delusion brought about by verbosity and circumlocution. But here the term has a deeper philosophical dimension. Here it is not a case of linguistic usage, but the behavior of the mind as such, since it concerns sense perception. The fact that it follows in the wake of vitakka is suggestive of its affinity to vichara, or discursive thought, so often quoted as the twin of vitakka, that is, as vitakka vichara. The mind has the tendency to wander afar, all alone, nurangamang ekacharan, through the medium of thought, or vitakka. When vitakka breaks loose and runs riot, it creates a certain deliberate state of mind, which is papancha. Comment? Yeah, I have identified as the salient point of this sermon, perception and its proliferation through papancha. And with this, we have come to the end of sermon 11, and therewith also to the end of this series of discussion this year. And next week there will be a summary by kindly offered to us by Bhikkhuni Dhammadina of the main point covered in these 11 sermons. And the plan is to have a similar course next year, where we will then be taking up sermons 12 to 22. Yeah, another set of 11 sermons. And so at this point, by way of just taking a short dip at the main point, what we are really concerned with is Nibbana, are basically two questions, I think. One is, what is the actual experience like? And the second is, what happens to the fully awakened one after death? And I think if we approach this from the viewpoint of the Kacchayanagotta Sutta, about the two extremes to be avoided, the existence and non-existence, and then with the help of the two verses that came up in this sermon, the Upasiva Manavapuccha and also the Kalavivada Sutta, I would just like to present my own understanding as a point for reflection, maybe to keep you some company until we meet again next year. And I have another little illustration now So let us imagine that making a fist stands for clinging. And now I make a fist and have one thumb up. This is for exists. And another fist, one thumb down. This is for does not exist. So both of these assertions, the two extremes in the Kacchayanagata Sutta, are, each of them is imbalanced. The affirmation exists ignores that things disappear. And because of this ignoring, it has to cling very strongly to affirm, is, exist, everything exists. And the affirmation exists not is equally unbalanced. It ignores the arising of things, so it also has to cling very tightly to is not, everything is not. And the two obviously are in conflict with each other. The one wants to kick out the other. No, it exists. No, it doesn't exist. Tum, tum. There's a constant conflict between these two views and a constant clinging. The solution comes by seeing that it's neither of the two. It is dependent arising. And I am now trying to exemplify this by interlocking my two thumbs. Instead of one pointing up and one pointing down, the two are now interlocked, dependent arising. And because by seeing dependent arising, the vision becomes comprehensive, arising and passing away can be accommodated, there's no longer so much need for clinging. The fists become more relaxed. And with continued seeing of the true nature of things as dependently arisen phenomena and impermanent phenomena, as the clinging becomes more and more relaxed, eventually the unconditioned is seen. Now, when I come to this point of the realization of Nibbana and of its implication for the after-death state of the Arahant, to bring in, again, existence and non-existence is to introduce clingings to a condition where clinging has long been left behind. It is meaningless. It is meaningless to try to understand either of these two in terms of existence and non-existence. If it is already impossible to explain the condition of the Arahant while still alive in terms of is and is not, how could is or is not be an appropriate way of approaching what happens after death? And the same with the experience of Nibbana. The question, is there something else when the sixth sense sphere sees, is papancha? Is there not something else? Is equally papancha. So what we have here is, in terms of the upasiva manavapuccha, the condition of the Arahant after death, just as much as the experience of Nibbana, these are beyond the range of language. An accurate description cannot be given. It can only be pointed at. And on Venerable Nyanananda's interpretation of the Kalavivada Sutta, the Nasanya Sanyi verse, then the experience of Nibbana, that what the stream enterer has, and whereby for the stream enterer this whole issue becomes clear, is a perception that is not a perception. It is the conscious experience of the cessation of consciousness. It is a sphere of experience, ayatana, where all six spheres of experience, salayatana, have gone into abeyance. And this much is what can be said. The finger pointing to the moon has a function. It just has to be understood properly what it can do. The finger itself is not the moon. It can only point to the moon, and I'm also not looking for the moon right at the top of the finger. The finger is far away from the moon. But the finger shows me a direction. So if I look along that direction and let go of the finger and keep looking, eventually I'll be able to see the moon. And that is what the finger can do. That is what these descriptions can do. They can only point in a direction. Thank you for your attention.